Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Leslie Gist of the Antique E Show. You will be listening to Mr. Wyatt Houston Day, a curator at Swan Galleries in New York City. Swan Galleries is an auction house, and Mr. Day will describe 16 different historical African-American artifacts which were featured in their auction this past February. Please sit back and relax. If you need to get in contact with Swan Galleries, their phone number is 212-254-4710, or you can visit them on the internet at Swan, S-W-A-N-N, galleries.com. Thank you.
The image that appears on the cover of the last Swan catalog of African-American material is a photograph by a very well-known photographer by the name of Ernest Withers. And that was a photograph taken at the strike of sanitation workers in Memphis that Dr. Martin Luther King went down to lend his support to. They had been really having a rough time there, being harassed and so forth by the local racists. And so Dr. King went down there to help and participated in the march with them. And those signs that said, "I am a man," were the placards. That there were actually a couple of placards that they carried, but that's the one that we know best. A week later, when Dr. King was killed, they were still demonstrating. Their new placard was printed, and that said, "End racism, honor Dr. King." Both of those signs are extremely rare. In late 96, I was pulling material together for the 1997 sale at Swan Galleries. And I had a dear friend, he's passed now, an African-American collector by the name of Oliver Ramsey. And Oliver had a huge collection of books and related material, African-American material. And I was at his apartment in New York City, and he said, you might be interested in this really strange thing, it's a very, very scarce thing. And he pulled this placard out of the closet, and it was that "I am a man" placard. It turns out Oliver had actually been down there in Memphis and marched, and he took his placard home. Being a collector, I guess he saw it, he knew that it was going to be something important, and he saved it. And I don't think many were saved, because in the years that I've been looking for others, I've only seen two others. So anyway, the end of the story is that I suggested, Oliver wanted to sell that placard, and I suggested we put it in the Swan sale, which I did. I cataloged it. And I think I had an estimate on it, because I thought it was a very, very good piece of $1,000 to $1,500 or $1,500 to $2,500. We always, in auctions, you always give a low and a high, and you hope that people will bid in between those two figures. And as it turned out, the placard sold for the poster, whatever you want to call it, sold for $5,200. It was an astonishing figure, really, for a placard, a civil rights placard. Since then, I've had people ask me, collectors ask me to find them one. I've been unable to. I have one standing order from somebody who said, "The sky's the limit. It doesn't matter what the cost is." And I know that one other copy sold for about $10,000. It is iconic of the civil rights movement. It says everything. I am a man. And by the way, it's a kind of harkens back to the early image of the kneeling slave that was created by Wedgwood, Josiah Wedgwood, for the Anti-Slavery Society in England in the late 18th century, that showed the slave kneeling, and it said, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And this is kind of affirmation of it. I am a man. So I think it's a wonderful full circle of confirmation. Yes, the Othello picture. Well, I think I'd be preaching to the choir if I tried to explain or say anything about Paul Rosen. We all know who he is, or we all should know who he is. I think the giant of the 20th century in terms of a really pure Renaissance man. Paul Robeson was not just an actor, although he's a fine, fine actor. He was a fine singer. He had a very rich voice, a wonderful rich voice, and a fine range at that. But what a lot of people don't know about Robeson was that he was a linguist. He was fascinated by language. He spoke a dozen languages and could read and get around in maybe 25 others, including, by the way, Chinese and Russian. And his son, a good friend of mine, Paul Jr., told me once that his dad, for fun, would sometimes take a song in Russian and translate it into Chinese. Now, for anybody, this has got to be an incredible task. Now, he's a brilliant, brilliant figure.
He graduated from Rutgers, right?
Yes, he did. And he was an all-star sports, football, baseball, track. Remarkable man. I think in football we refer to people as a Renaissance man. He certainly is that, if you think of a person who's really good at a number of different things. Yes, well, again, these are names that I think everybody should be aware of. Carver was an educator, scientist, teacher, humanitarian. And I think most people just think of George Washington Carver and they think of the peanut. But beyond his experiments with the peanut and really bringing that into our lives, anybody who's had a peanut butter sandwich should really remember why we have things like peanut butter and how important it is in terms of a nutritious food. Carver was interested in finding ways to develop nutritious food. He did a lot of experiments with food, finding ways to make different kinds of flour, for instance, from sweet potato. And in this same sale, I not only have that photograph of George Washington Carver, but we also have a recipe suggestion for different ways to use a sweet potato. We know about his teaching and at Tuskegee and so forth. He's another one of these giant figures that so much impacted so much on people's lives. Sadly enough, I must say, I think that there are two figures that both of them teachers and humanitarians, and it would be Carver and George and Booker T. Washington. And I think that people kind of have taken them for granted. And I think in the case of Booker T. Washington, for instance, he's gotten something of a bad rap as a compromiser and appeaser. But I think that that's because people thinking in more radical terms, kind of people divided up at a certain point in the 20th century as Du Bois men and Booker T. Washington. And I think that if we look back at Booker T., I think he's a lot more important than so many modern people would like to dismiss him as kind of the bootstrap, the appeaser, and Carver too. These, I guess, there's a lot of. I'm wandering, but I think the issue is that there's just so much material connected with them out there that we've kind of taken them for granted, and that's unfair. I think that that both of them should be studied more by today's scholars and so forth.
How does he compare to Du Bois? Du Bois is
well, I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that they're really very different. Du Bois is the more radical voice of the black community in the 20th century. You remember that they're pretty much they overlap a bit, but they're both strong voices in the early part of the 20th century.
Which one has the most demand for
today,
the collectors? Yes,
I'd say Du Bois, of course. I mean, I find Du Bois a tremendous, tremendous figure. They have different roles in the evolution of black thought and race progress in the 20th century.
So Du Bois' items are worth more today than...
Well, there's more. I think more people are interested today in terms of collectors and so forth in Du Bois, and I think that we tend to think in more radical terms today, and so we relate more to W.E.B. Du Bois than we relate to Booker T. Washington. And it would depend. For instance, I had some manuscript notes of Booker T. Washington in the sale, and I had a few last year as well. And they brought big prices. Let me see. I have my catalog here, but I think that this group of 12 pages of manuscript notes for speeches by Booker T. Washington brought $4,600 hammer. Now, what that means in an auction, by the way, is when we talk about a hammer price, that means the price that was in the room when the auctioneer says going, going, gone, bang, and he wraps his little hammer down. It's that figure. But in fact, the buyer has to pay that plus 20% to the auction house. Otherwise, the auction house can't stay in business. We don't make the money. Our consigner makes the money for instance, in this instance, $4,600. That goes to the consigner. We charge 20% above that to the buyer, and that's what the auction house makes. That's what any auction house makes, is a percentage over the bid. But before I wander too far off on explaining that, that's a good price, $4,600, probably about $5,400 with those premiums, the commissions. Last year, I had a similar group of notes from Booker T. that sold for $10,000. So it really depends on what the material is. I think on the other hand, a similar grouping of notes in Du Bois' hand might bring more, simply because I think that today's audience is just a little bit more geared toward Du Bois than they are toward Booker T. But then that's all speculation, because if you have the right two people in the room who are really interested, the bidding on something like that could go anywhere.
Great. I'm going to move on to the poster he has, which says, United, we win.
United, we win.
Okay, that's a World War II poster, and it was an attempt by the government to show unity amongst the races in America. There were many posters during World War II to either show this kind of unity as a war effort, buy bonds, for instance. Today, people don't realize that the war was in large part funded by the American people by buying war bonds. They were called war bonds, and like T-notes today, like treasury notes. And there were many, many posters generated, some for to kind of encourage enlistment amongst people of color. Others were to get people to buy war bonds. And United We Win is kind of a combination of both.
How did you obtain it?
It came from a consigner.
Oh, okay.
Much of the material that I say much, all of it, in the sale. Swan or any auction gallery doesn't own anything. We simply process it. We're kind of a nexus. We're a gathering point where people bring their material, and it is then cataloged by me in this instance. But I may have in any given sale, I may have an average sale is usually about 385 different lots. And I may have as many as 200 consigners or more.
Okay. And how many of those war posters you think you get every year?
Well, different kinds of posters.
Related to the war.
Related to World War II, usually there are at least two or three. Okay. I've had as many as four or five and different ones. As I say, many were generated.
Oh, okay. So they're not rare.
No, they're rare.
Oh, they are?
They bring anywhere from $1,500 to as much as $3,500 or $4,500. No, that don't be misled by any numbers of things that appear in this sale that I've put together, because I really work hard to root things out and constantly being proactive. I can't just wait for things to walk in the door. I'm in contact with people all the time to try and encourage them to consign material. And of course, now it's 15 years of doing this sale, and there's a kind of momentum to it, so people constantly calling me and asking me about something that they may have found at a tag sale or that was in their attic and so forth. So it's kind of an ongoing process. Some things turn up again and again. Things that occur in multiples, like published books or posters and things. Sometimes I get one and I never see another.
Okay, he was talking about a poster, a military poster of a black man and a white man working together, and it said, "United we win." We're up to photo number 6. Marcus Garvey's.
Is Marcus Garvey's stock, Marcus Garvey's ship, and Marcus Garvey's Black Cross Nurse.
Okay, Marcus Garvey. Now, here's a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier about where our heads are at today. Marcus Garvey is a radical thinker. And I think that the renewed interest in Marcus Garvey in the past 15 years or so, 20 years. And I say that generally because for those who are really, really in the know and people who have been really aware of radical movements, everything from Garvey, and there were guys before him too, through Malcolm, that people were aware of him, but I say it's a general awareness of Marcus Garvey. He's become much more of a well-known name in the past 15 or 20 years. And as a result, anything by him or connected to the movement he founded, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, was incredible for its day and what Garvey was able to accomplish. His aim was to unite all people of color and have a connection with Africa. What actually brought him down in the end was part of his shipping line, the Black Star Line, and I think that's one of the pieces that you mentioned. It was a shipping line that Garvey founded. And the idea was that goods produced in Africa would be imported into the U.S. and money would go back into Africa. Goods would be produced by people of African descent here, would be shipped back, and there would be this constant ebb and flow between Africa and the United States and the Caribbean as well, because after all, Garvey was a Jamaican. So now, at one point, and you have to figure that there were probably more people connected with the UNIA than there were people who directly connected with St. Malcolm. I mean, the people who were card-carrying members of the UNIA. It was a tremendous movement. And as such, the FBI here, Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, set out to undo Garvey. I mean, he was the real top target, more than crime in this country or anything else. He became their prime target. So he had people infiltrate the movement. And at one point, when Garvey's Black Star line, the shipping line, was about to acquire another ship, they hadn't yet put the money down on it, but they were pretty much in contract to acquire this ship. And it was to be called the Phyllis Wheatley, after the great poet. And as I say, they had not yet as yet acquired the ship. But one of their people, one of the UNIA people in the publicity department, soliciting some money to buy the ship, because they were constantly soliciting funds and selling stock shares in the Black Star line, somebody airbrushed the name of the ship, the Phyllis Wheatley, onto the photograph that was used in the material sent out through the post office to solicit funds. And that one thing was able to undo Garvey. The FBI had their excuse, which was soliciting funds through the mail illegally, because it was just a loophole. The illegality of it was that Garvey didn't yet own that ship. And so they charged him with mail fraud, and he was sentenced to something like 30 years, and he was sent to a prison in Georgia. There was such a hue and cry from people both here in the United States and throughout the world, because he had people in the movement in England and everywhere. There were people in the UNI movement. Anyway, there was such a hue and cry that they were forced to let him go. He was allowed to leave prison, and he was deported. And after that, the movement kind of fell apart, though he went first to Jamaica, then back to England, went to England, and the movement sort of sputtered and died out there. About 1940s, the late 40s, it kind of just sputtered out. Okay, well, the Black Cross nurses were part of the UNIA movement. It was a brilliant movement when you think of the fact that they had built into the movement people who were trained in nursing and medicine to be in the community to help out. I think that it was such an extraordinarily complex and caring movement that it appealed to so many people, that you could have a nurse. Think about it. I mean, that to have nurses, a brigade of nurses involved in your movement, it shows tremendous foresight and outreach into the community.
Okay, we're up to number eight.
As I say, a division of the movement.
Number eight, hip hop rap pioneers.
Okay, well, that's the film. It's a poster for the film, and I don't know. Probably some people out there will remember. There was a group called The Last Poets. The Last Poets were a group of people who, and many people think, were the forerunners of rap. They recited their poetry to a kind of jazz background, and that was Felipe Luciano, David Nelson, Dallin Kane. They were really early rappers, and any kind of memorabilia connected with them is really very much in demand with people who are interested in hip-hop and rap.
Okay, how much do they go for?
Well, the one poster went for $700, and I think the other one went for $400, the smaller one.
Okay.
And they're very, I have to point out, I'm disappointed. I thought that they might bring more. I put an estimate, I think, on the one that brought $700. I put an estimate of $1,000 to $1,500, and I kind of hoped that it would bring closer to the $1,500, and I think it's worth that and more. So to your listeners, if anybody out there finds anything connected with the Last Poets poster or something connected with them, it's highly collectible. It's really, really the kind of the granddaddies of the rap movement. Heroes of the Colored Race is the one with Frederick Douglass and Blanche.
Dr. Meadows?
Yes?
You have anything to say before I go on to Heroes of the Colored Race?
I kind of hear something that I think you got cut off a little bit with the thing. I don't think I went blank a little bit.
Okay. Well, let me let you hear it again.
Go ahead. I'm not good.
Yeah, Heroes of the Colored Race is the one with Frederick Douglass and Blanche Bruce and Hiram Revels. These are, of course, three giants. Frederick Douglass, I don't think I need to tell anybody about, but not many people are aware of who Hiram Revels was or Blanche Bruce. Hiram Revels was both Blanche Bruce and Hiram Revels are very important post-Civil War politicians, black politicians. And this particular poster shows not just those three figures as heroes, but shows the black race as heroic. We're showing the people on the if your audience out there could see this, they would be able to see that this is a color poster. And in the center of it, you see Frederick Douglass, and to one side, Blanche Bruce, to the other, Hiram Revels. And to the left side of the poster, we see people in the cotton fields, and we see people being rounded up by slavers and so forth. And in the right-hand side, we see black soldiers in the Civil War, black troopers, and a classroom with a black teacher and students. And all around the edges of this poster are smaller little oval portraits of people like John Brown and other well-known figures in the 19th century.
Okay.
So it's a wonderful poster. It's very, very rare. It's what we call a chromolithographic poster.
When was it made, produced?
I'm sorry?
When was it produced?
It was produced about 1880s or 1890s. There's no date on this particular one, but we know it was made about then. It brought a very high figure. The hammer, I've explained that what that was before, was $8,000, which means that there's 20% more on top of that, or $1,600 more. So $9,600 is what this poster sold for.
Wow.
Very, very rare.
10. Wells Barnett, Ida Bell.
Actually, that I can talk about for a moment, but that photograph was removed because it turned out that it was not her. Yeah, it was an error. There aren't but maybe two images, known images of Ida Wells. And
who is she?
It looked like her, and my consigner had been sold to my consigner as such, and it looked like her to me. But an expert, a scholar who had written about Ida Wells, called me up and we spoke, and I said, well, if I err at all, I'm going to err on the side of caution, so we removed it. But I should say about Ida Wells, she was probably best known as a campaigner against lynching. There was lynching in this country in the early part of the 20th century had reached incredible proportions. I mean, the number of reported lynchings was in double digits and triple. I mean, at one point there was the NAACP in the early reports. NAACP, as you know, was founded in 1910. And we're coming up on the anniversary, by the way. Founded by W.E.B. Du Bois and Mary White Ovington and others. But the NAACP, for a while in the early part of the century, kept figures in their annual reports of the number of lynchings, reported lynchings. Now, that's an important word here, because we just don't know how many lynchings were never reported.
Mm-hmm.
For people, for fear of even talking about, let's say, somebody in their family disappearing, for fear of talking.
All right, any comments, Dr. Matters?
No comments.
All right, we're going up to CJ, Madam CJ Walker.
They should. Okay, Madam Walker is the first black millionaire in America. There's actually a woman before her, Mary Turnbull Malone, who had a similar manufacturing company, made hair products. And she had a beauty school also called the Poro, P-O-R-O, school. But I don't think she really made it to status of millionaire, but close to it. But Madam Walker was more than simply the name behind this line of hair products for black women. She was a philanthropist and activist, and her story is remarkable. I mean, she came from just the lowest of the low, poor background, just had to fight every which way up to just keep her head above water with a child and so forth. And she had a tremendous, tremendous business head. I mean, she really was able to envision a whole business behind these hair products, hair things that kept you from losing your hair, because there was, early on, I don't have to tell people how many people used hot irons and stuff, which would just destroy hair, make it brittle and fall out, and so forth. She came up with products that were really healthy for the scalp, and it just, everything snowballed. I mean, she made millions of dollars. She was able to put together build an enormous, enormous factory in Indianapolis, and a theater. And actually, the theater was really not much of that was her business advisors one hadn't built this theater much against her advice, and that cost the Walker company a lot of money. It was a big drain on them, and I think it's, I'd forgotten just about when the company petered out, in the 1940s, I believe.
Okay, can you hear me?
Me?
Okay, all right, just want to make sure you're with me. William Wilberforce, before we go on to William Wilberforce, I just purchased a book at the Harlem Book Fair, an old book written by Carter Woodson, George Carter Woodson, and he has a picture of her mansion in that book. So maybe I can scan it and upload that picture. Now let's go on to William Wilberforce. And this is about a coin that was, or a medal that was made to commemorate his work with anti-slavery.
13. William Wilberforce, the copper commemorative medal.
Oh, okay. Well, William Wilberforce, there are the strongest abolitionist movement, we have to understand it was not America. Although we always think of the Emancipation Proclamation and so forth, the real first gestures toward doing away with slavery and doing away with the slave trade came from the British. And the first act was in 1807, the British passed an act through their parliament to put a ban on the slave trade. And what that means is that while slavery still existed, you could no longer take any slaves out of Africa. And the British didn't just make the rule and just make a rule. They actually outfitted and sent their navy to the west coast of Africa to patrol the coast and make sure that these essentially pirates were not taking slaves out of Africa. And the second thing, which I'll mention, then we'll go back to the 1807, was in 1833 and passed in 1834 the Parliamentary Act which emancipated the West Indies. That set in motion really the strongest movement in the United States to do away with slavery here. That, as I say, was 1834. To go back to William Wilberforce, there were two figures, three figures actually, but two main figures in Great Britain that are behind the abolition movement. One of them is Thomas Clarkson, and the other is William Wilberforce. Wilberforce was a member of Parliament, and he sponsored repeated attempts to put an end to the slave trade. Understanding, I mean, that if you think about what slavery meant in terms of an economic engine in the about the last quarter of the 18th century into the 19th century, everything grew because of slavery. Banks, insurance companies, just colleges, everything was financed on the back of slaves. Anyway, the best known agitator toward abolition, at least in the Parliament, was William Wilberforce, who in 1791 had a diagram engraved, Clarkson and he together, the very, very famous and infamous diagram of the whole of the slave ship. I'm sure many people have seen this, where people were stacked just like cordwood in the hold of the ship. And if you think about how incredible, how horrific this must have been, as many as 300, 400 people laying side by side by side in layers in the hold of a ship coming across the Atlantic, it's just hard to even really get your head around it. In any case, Wilberforce, for the first time, brought this to the attention of all the members of Parliament with a big diagram, with this big engraving, which was then reprinted as a smaller, manageable size engraving and put in a book, a pamphlet called An Abstract of the Evidence, and the evidence was the evidence of the horrors of the slave trade. And I've had that book in the Swan Sale a couple of times. It's something that brings in the neighborhood at the least amount, somewhere around $1,200 or $1,500, and the most about $3,500. The diagram of the slave ship, which is really largely due to, we have that evidence, as it were, of how horrible it was then, because of people like Clarkson and Wilberforce. And so this medal was struck in honor of William Wilberforce. It's very rare. I can't think that very many of them were issued. I don't think I was able to determine how many are in existence for the catalog, but not many. And
did that one sell?
Yes, it did. There's a lot of big commemorative medals like this out there, but there are little what we call tokens, little coin that are anti-slavery tokens. They call them, show the kneeling slave that says, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And the other one says, "Am I not a woman and a sister?" those are out there, and they're very collectible. But these big ones like this are rare.
Okay, we're moving on to Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation.
Number 14, Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation.
Okay, well, this particular version, there were many, many versions of the Emancipation Proclamation engraved, and they were engraved to be hung on walls, etc. They were engraved as I can't say souvenir, but as a memento of that event. This is one of them. This is one of the nicer ones, but there are probably only about 15 or 20 different engraved versions. And I'm not sure on that figure, but there are a number of them. This one was engraved by a man by the name of Rufus Blanchard, published this.
What year?
1863.
Oh, okay.
63 to 64, but right around the time of the Emancipation Proclamation. And they, all of these different engraved versions of the proclamation bring good prices. This particular one had needed some conservation. By that I mean that the paper was rather brittle, and conservation is a lot of different aspects to conservation, but it is just what it sounds like, to conserve it, to preserve it. The paper is put in a chemical bath, which stops all oxidation of the paper, all the deterioration of the paper, and then you can assure that that this will not further disintegrate or fall apart. And depending on how much damage there is to the paper, a process like this might cost as much as $500, $600. But if you want to preserve something as rare and wonderful as this, that's worth the investment. So if this piece had not needed that, it probably would have brought more in the neighborhood of $5,000 or $6,000. I think as it did, it brought something like $3,000.
All right. We're up to Frederick Douglass's letter. And before I move on, I just want the listeners to know that Wyatt Houston Day, he is also a part, or he used to be a part, of the Antique Roadshow. So let's listen to what he has to say about Frederick Douglass's letter.
15, letter signed, Douglass, Frederick Douglass.
Okay, the Frederick Douglass letter was contained in a book. And the book is the Douglass's autobiography. And Douglass wrote, in fact, four autobiographies. The first one, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, appeared in 1845. The next one was 1855, and that's called My Bondage and My Freedom, in which he brings his life up to date to 1855. Then he wrote another narrative in 1881, and this is the one that we're talking about here. This is the one published in 1881, although this is the second printing from 1882. But the important thing here is a letter that's tipped into, attached to, the inside of the book, written by Douglass to a man who had sent him a letter complimenting him on this book, and requesting an autograph, perhaps. And Douglass has a very nice reply to him, saying that how nice it is to have heard from him, that it was a very bad year. And in fact, it was a terrible year for Douglass. Douglass's wife had just passed away in August of 1882, and he was very, very, very affected by her passing. So this was quite wonderful, and it sold, by the way, interestingly, this sale, though it did very well, did not do as well, perhaps, as it might have if we hadn't gone into a terrible economic toilet in the latter part of 2008. Normally, this letter attached to a book, and it was a good letter, should have brought more money, like $5,000, but it bought $3,200. So somebody got themselves a very nice bargain.
All right, we're moving on to a black film.
Yes, this is more than a film. What this is, this was really the star of the show. A couple of years back, a friend of mine who's a scholar at Langston, he's retired, but he was a scholar at Langston University in Oklahoma, a black university. And his name is Curry Ballard, he's a good friend of mine. Curry had come upon this film. Someone contacted him, a white dealer out in Oklahoma, had contacted him because he was known to be a collector of black history and so forth. He is black. And they said, well, you'd be interested in this. It's some film of black folks. So Curry was, of course, interested and met with the guy. And there were 29 cans of film, 16-millimeter film, shot by a black Baptist minister by the name of Solomon S. Jones. And he shot all this film between 1925 and 1928. And what it was is film of the black communities out in Oklahoma, some of which were very wealthy because of oil on their property. And remember, the decade between 1920 and 1930 or so was a real booming decade just before the crash. And so these are wonderful five and a half hours of film, wonderful film, showing all kinds of aspects of black community life, everything from schools, churches, baptisms, funerals, police, everything. And not just in the townships there in Oklahoma. Jones traveled to Indianapolis and filmed Madam Walker's factory. He traveled to black communities around the country, to Harlem. He went to Chicago, Detroit. And then he decided he'd travel to Europe, and he traveled to Europe and the Holy Land, and he filmed there. This is 5.5 hours of the world as seen by a black minister, and the black world at that. It's a lot of the focus. Most of the film is of the African American communities here in the States. And the film was sold to a major university for $43,000, where it will be now used for research and process, and God knows how many wonderful documentaries will come out of this.
Which university? Are you allowed to say?
I'm afraid I'm not able to tell you, but if your folks keep your ears to the ground, they should be making an announcement, Tom, before the end of the year.
All right. We're up to a question I asked Mr. Wyatt Houston Day about a patent examiner, a black patent examiner named Mr. Henry E. Baker.
I wanted to ask you about Henry Baker. We talked much earlier about Henry Baker. He chronicled all the black inventors in at least a 5-set volume. That's something
that I'm looking for. When was this published?
The late 1800s. Henry E. Baker.
Henry E. Baker. I confess, and this will take me a second if you want me to. This is a perfect example of the fact that this is an ongoing learning process. That this is something that I'm unaware of. And I'm just about to. Okay, let me see something. Doesn't show up. He doesn't show up in the Harvard. We did a huge study called the African American National Biography Project, and that was headed by Henry Louis Gates, and that's a huge study. I mean, there's 8 volumes, and there'd be more added, 8 volumes of biography. So he may not be black, Baker. And I haven't heard of him. I would give my eye teeth for a copy. Where did you get the reference?
They're from a documentary about black inventors. And you could look at the credits and see where they got their information.
Black inventors in the age of segregation.
Baker.
I got Howard E. Baker. Let's see what this is.
Maybe
black inventors in the age of segregation that have a... No, this is a book about 3 major guys, Louis Latimer, who worked with Edison and Shelby J. Davidson. No, this is a different book.
Close, because it is E. Baker. I remember, I'm pretty sure it's Henry.
No, I am not finding a reference to him either. On the Henry E. Baker. Here we go. Okay. Know something about him. Henry E. Baker is the first African-American patent examiner.
Mm. Bingo!
A patent examiner. So, I'm just going to have to... Well, you set me off on a lead. I'm just going to have to find out what this is all about and see if I can find a copy of these things. Because if he was the patent examiner, it means that there are countless patents that he looked at, white and black. There were positions in the period following the Civil War and through Reconstruction, and those many of those were eliminated later. But there were a lot of positions in government which would seem to be minor positions, like post office or deed examiner of deeds. Frederick Douglass was examiner of deeds for a while, and U.S. Marshal, that's another position. And so probably patent examiner was something akin to that. And I'm going to have to investigate that.
You're going to keep me abreast of your investigation, right?
I will indeed.
Okay.
All right. Henry E. Baker, you can learn more about him on YouTube. The name of the video is Making It Happen. The video is also featured on the Blog Talk Radio's website at the Antique E Show. All right, we're going to move on to a question I asked Mr. Wyatt Houston Day about collecting President Obama's material and also Michael Jackson.
President Obama and Michael Jackson.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, a lot of people, I'm sure, are wondering. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering about how collectible material connected with both President Obama and Michael Jackson, how collectible all that is. Well, clearly, I think if you look at in the week following Michael Jackson's death, over 500,000 copies of his albums were sold in a week, just following his death. And just to put that in some kind of perspective, in the years and so forth before that, the sales were maybe 150,000, 200,000 over the course of a year or something. Things had kind of fallen off. People would still be buying copies of Thriller as new generations discovered him, but that shows you what kind of interest was suddenly generated. So if that's the case with people buying copies of new albums, 500,000 of them, and you can just imagine what signed copies of Moonwalk, which is his book, and anything else like signed photos or anything else connected with Jackson is going to, how that's going to hit the market. I would say to everybody out there, if you have something connected to either President Obama or Michael Jackson, I would just sit on it for a while. Rather than get caught up in the craze right now, right after the election, copies of the New York Times that announced Obama as the winner were selling on eBay for as much as $200. And in fact, you could buy, as I did, buy a couple of copies of it at Grand Central Station, which I did on my way to work. I'd just be cautious about instant memorabilia, instant collectibles. Things need time to put them in focus.
Now, you mentioned signed. You really place an emphasis on the word signed.
Well, yes. I mean, a copy of Moonwalk is not going to be worth anything more than it's worth the day after Michael's dead than it was the day before. It had a huge printing. Mm. The only thing I can see is, you know, we look at these things as real, you know, what is a real collectible? A signed book, a book signed by its author, is always going to be worth more than an unsigned copy. And if you look at a modern book, they're huge printings. So I think that nobody should jumped the gun. If most people are online these days, if you look at eBay and just take a look at how many copies of Michael Jackson's book are up there, and they run from the ridiculous to the sublime. There's just all kinds of prices everywhere. I'm not saying, you know, that if somebody managed to have a signed photograph or something like that, that it's going to be worth more money than it was before his passing. But, you know, I'm very, very conservative about stuff like this. I think that one thing is real collectible value is for historical material, and the other is stuff that's based on some kind of craze that will settle down and change.
Okay, now, President Obama's, which one is more valuable?
Well, his first book, his first book is still, and copies of the first edition sell for a huge sum.
Signed or not signed?
Just plain copies are valuable, and signed copies, there aren't all of that many, but signed copies, I don't even know what they're going for, the current price, because, tell you the truth, as I say, I don't follow immediate trends.
Right.
That closely, because in fact I just don't believe in them. The image that appears on the cover of the Last Swan catalog of African American material is a photograph by a very well-known photographer by the name of Ernest Withers, and that was a photograph taken at the strike of sanitation workers in Memphis that Dr. Martin Luther King went down to lend his support to. They had been really having a rough time there, being harassed and so forth by the local racists. And so Dr. King went down there to help and participated in the march with them. And those signs that said, "I am a man," or were the placards that there was... Actually, a couple of placards that they carried, but that's the one that we know best. A week later, when Dr. King was killed, they were still demonstrating. Their new placard was printed, and that said, "End racism, honor Dr. King." Both of those signs are extremely rare. In 1996, late 96, I was pulling material together for the 1997 sale at Swan Galleries, and I had a dear friend who's passed now, an African-American collector by the name of Oliver Ramsey, and Oliver had a huge collection of books and related material, African-American material, and I was at his apartment in New York City, and he said, "Oh, you might be interested in this. This is a really strange thing. It's a very, very scarce thing." And he pulled this placard out of the closet, and it was that "I am a man" placard. It turns out Oliver had actually been down there in Memphis and marched, and he took his placard home. Being a collector, I guess he saw it, he knew that it was going to be something important, and he saved it. And I don't think many were saved, because in the years that I've been looking for others, I've only seen two others. So anyway, the end of the story is that Oliver wanted to sell that placard, and I suggested we put it in the Swan sale, which I did. I cataloged it. And I think I had an estimate on it, because I thought it was a very, very good piece of $1,000 to $1,500, or $1,500 to $2,500. We always, in auctions, you always give a low and a high, and you hope that people will bid in between those two figures. And as it turned out, the placard sold for the poster, whatever you want to call it, sold for $5,200. An astonishing figure, really, for a placard, a civil rights placard. Since then, I've had people ask me, collectors ask me to find them one. I've been unable to. I have one standing order from somebody who said, "The sky's the limit. It doesn't matter what the cost is." And I know that one other one of the copies sold for about $10,000. It is iconic of the civil rights movement. It says everything. I am a man. And by the way, it's a kind of harkens back to the early image of the kneeling slave that was created by Wedgwood, Josiah Wedgwood, for the Anti-Slavery Society in England in the late 18th century, that showed the slave kneeling, and it said, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And this is kind of affirmation of it. I am a man. And so I think it's a wonderful full circle of confirmation.
Okay, this is Leslie Gist of the Antique E-Show. You are listening to Mr. Wyatt Houston Day. We will bring up another clip from Mr. Houston Day's talk about historical African-American artifacts at the Swan Gallery. You can look at more artifacts at swangalleries.com. Thank you for tuning in. And let's go back to Mr. Wyatt Houston Day. Okay. I'm sorry. Try Wyatt.
Yes, well, again, these are names that I think everybody should be aware of. Carver was an educator, scientist, teacher, humanitarian. And I think most people just think of George Washington Carver and they think of the peanut. But beyond his experiments with the peanut and really bringing that into our lives, anybody who's had a peanut butter sandwich should really remember why we have things like peanut butter and how important it is in terms of a nutritious food. Carver was interested in finding ways to develop nutritious food. He did a lot of experiments with food, finding ways to make different kinds of flour. Flour, for instance, from sweet potato. And in this same sale, I not only have that photograph of George Washington Carver, but we also have a recipe suggestion for different ways to, I think it is, to use a sweet potato.
Is Marcus Garvey's stock, Marcus Garvey's ship, and Marcus Garvey's Black Cross Nurse?
Okay, Marcus Garvey. Now, here's a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier about where our heads are at today. Marcus Garvey is a radical thinker, and I think that the renewed interest in Marcus Garvey in the past 15 years or so, 20 years, and I say that generally because for those who are really, really in the know and people who have been really aware of radical movements, everything from Garvey, and there were guys before him too, through Malcolm, that people were aware of him, but I say it's a general awareness of Marcus Garvey. He's become much more of a well-known name in the past 15 or 20 years, and as a result, anything by him or connected to the movement he founded, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. The Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, was incredible for its day and what Garvey was able to accomplish. His aim was to unite all people of color and have a connection with Africa. What actually brought him down in the end was part of his shipping line, the Black Star Line, And I think that's one of the pieces that that you mentioned. The was a shipping line that Garvey founded. And the idea was that goods produced in Africa would be imported into the U.S. and money would go back into Africa. Goods would be produced by people of African descent here, would be shipped back, and there would be this constant ebb and flow between Africa and the United States and the Caribbean as well, because after all, Garvey was a Jamaican. So now, at one point, and you have to figure that there were probably more people connected with the UNIA than there were people who directly connected with, let's say, Malcolm. I mean, the people who were card-carrying members of the UNIA. It was a tremendous movement. And of course, as such, the FBI here, Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, set out to undo Garvey. I mean, he was the real top target, more than crime in this country or anything else. He became their prime target. So he had people infiltrate the movement. And at one point, when Garvey's Black Star line, the shipping line, was about to acquire another ship, they hadn't yet put the money down on it, but they were pretty much in contract to acquire this ship. And it was to be called the Phyllis Wheatley, after the great poet. And as I say, they had not yet as yet acquired the ship, but one of their people, one of the UNIA people in the publicity department, soliciting some money to buy the ship, because they were constantly soliciting funds and selling stock shares in the Black Star line, somebody airbrushed the name of the ship, the Phyllis Wheatley, onto the photograph that was used in the material sent out through the post office to solicit funds. And that one thing was able to undo Garvey. The FBI had their excuse, which was soliciting funds through the mail illegally, because it was just a loophole. The illegality of it was that Garvey didn't yet own that ship. And so they charged him with mail fraud, and he was sentenced to something like 30 years, and he was sent to a prison in Georgia. There was such a hue and cry from people both here in the United States and throughout the world, because he had people in the movement in England and everywhere. There were people in the UNI movement. Anyway, there was such a hue and cry that they were forced to let him go. He was allowed to leave prison, and he was deported. And after that, the movement kind of fell apart, though he went first to Jamaica, then back to England, went to England, and the movement sort of sputtered and died out there. In the 1940s, the late 40s, it kind of just sputtered out. Okay, well, the Black Cross nurses were a part of the UNIA movement. It was a brilliant movement when you think of the fact that they had built into the movement people who were trained in nursing and medicine to be in the community to help out. I think that it was such an extraordinarily complex and caring movement that it appealed to so many people, that you could have a nurse. Think about it. I mean, that to have nurses, a brigade of nurses involved in your movement, it shows tremendous foresight and outreach into the community.
Okay, we're up
and
to number eight.
As I say, a division of the movement. Heroes of the Colored Race is the one with Frederick Douglass and Blanche Bruce and Hiram Revels. These are, of course, three giants. Frederick Douglass, I don't think I need to tell anybody about, but not many people are aware of who Hiram Revels was or Blanche Bruce. Hiram Revels was a both Clarence Bruce and Hiram Revels are very important post-Civil War politicians, black politicians. And this particular poster shows not just those three figures as heroes, but shows the black race as heroic, showing the people on the if your audience out there could see this, they would be able to see that this is a color poster, and in the center of it you see Frederick Douglass, and to one side Blanche Bruce, to the other Hiram Revels, and to the left side of the poster we see people in the cotton fields, and we see people being rounded up by slavers and so forth, and in the right hand side we see black soldiers in the Civil War, black troopers, and a classroom with a black teacher and students. And all around the edges of this poster are smaller little oval portraits of people like John Brown and other well-known figures in the 19th century.
Okay.
So it's a wonderful poster. It's very, very rare. It's what we call a chromolithographic poster.
When was it made, produced?
I'm sorry?
When was it produced?
It was produced about 1880s or 1890s. There's no date on this particular one, but we know it was made about then. It brought a very high figure. The hammer, I've explained that what that was before, was $8,000, which means that there's 20% more on top of that, or $1,600 more. So $9,600 is what this poster sold for.
Wow.
Very, very rare.
Is it popular
Yes.
in a lot of books?
It's shown in a couple of books, and it's I think your audience would be able to see a copy of it if you're online, if you have a computer, and you just type in Heroes of the Colored Race. It will probably take you to an image of this, which I think would be the Library of Congress, National Portrait Gallery, or one of those sites would probably have this image.
10. Wells Barnett, Ida Bell.
Actually, that I can talk about for a moment, but that photograph was removed because it turned out that it was not her. Yeah, it was an error. There aren't but maybe two images, known images of Ida Wells. And
who is she?
It looked like her, and my consigner had been sold to my consigner as such, and it looked like her to me, but an expert, a scholar who had written about Ida Wells, called me up and we spoke, and I said, "Well, if I err at all, I'm going to err on the side of caution," so we removed it. But I should say about Ida Wells, she was probably best known as a campaigner against lynching. There was lynching in this country. In the early part of the 20th century, had reached incredible proportions. I mean, the number of reported lynchings was in double digits and triple. I mean, at one point there was the NAACP in the early reports. NAACP, as you know, was founded in 1910, and we're coming up on the anniversary, by the way. Founded by W.E.B. Du Bois and Mary White Ovington and others. But the NAACP, for a while in the early part of the century, kept figures in their annual reports of the number of lynchings, reported lynchings. Now, that's an important word here, because we just don't know how many lynchings were never reported for people, for fear of even talking about, let's say, somebody in their family disappearing, for fear of talking. They should. Okay, Madam Walker is the first black millionaire in America. There's actually a woman before her, Mary Turnbull Malone, who had a
Hello, Mr. White, Houston Day. Are you on the line?
I'm on the line here.
Great. I'm so glad you called us. I apologize for the misunderstanding, but I'm so happy that the audience can hear your voice live on the air because I could not actually get your recording of who you are on the Blog Talk Radio show.
Okay.
So
I
need you to introduce yourself nice and clear because the audio we had, it was too low. The volume was too low.
Oh, okay. Well, my name is Wyatt Houston Day, and some people might know me from the auction that I conduct once a year for Swan Galleries in New York. That's an auction of African-American history, literature, photography, art, etc. And I also am an appraiser and historian. I appraise African-American archives, historical material, for either donation or for people who need insurance values and so forth on their papers or whatever they may be, artifacts. So that's
now,
me.
Mm-hmm. I never heard anything about donations. This is the first time.
Well, sometimes people have something of value. I'll give you a perfect example. About a year and a half ago, I received a phone call from a person who was recommended by the Schomburg Center in New York, the Schomburg Center for Black History and Culture. And they had a collection, an archive, if you will, a collection of papers from, it was a woman whose father had been a Tuskegee Airman. And she had a big carton full of his papers, and they were very important. They had to do with the case of the Tuskegee Airmen at the Air Force Base during World War II. And she wanted to give them to the Schomburg. She didn't want to sell them. She wanted to give them to the Schomburg. Now, if you give, if you donate something of substantial value, you can get a tax write-off. You can get a tax break. It depends on how much, what the value of what you're giving is. So come tax time, if you can produce a piece of paper from an appraiser that says that what you gave to whoever, whether it's your local church or a library like the Schomburg or a museum, whatever, it has to be some sort of an institution, you can get a tax break. It's a percentage of the value of what you donated.
Okay, now, how did they know to contact you?
Well, they went to the person was an African-American woman, of course, her father being a Tuskegee Airman. She went to the Schomburg Center in New York, and they recommended me. I've done a lot of work for them over the years. But I can be found on the internet, or I can provide you with my email, and if anybody needs advice or wants to ask me a question that way, I'd be very happy to answer to the best of my ability. And that's I see. Leslie, do you have my email?
I'm hoping that you will.
Well, I'll
provide
it
right
now.
Now.
Okay, it's my initials WHD. And then that's followed by what's called an underscore, which is if you hit the shift button and a dash, you get an underscore. It's like a dash, but it lays on the bottom of the line. So my initials, WHD underscore, SHD underscore, booksellers at yahoo.com. Okay.
And you're also affiliated with Swan?
I am. I am the head of the African-American department for that auction gallery.
Now, how is it that you became interested in African-American collectibles?
Well, not so much collectibles. I think I became interested in Africa, period, when I was about 10 or 11. I started reading books. I was fascinated by the books by explorers, and the more I read about Africa, the more I became interested. And it's kind of been a love affair with the continent and the history of the continent all my life. I have to say, I didn't become a bookseller and do what I'm doing right now until 1980. I've been in the music business virtually all my life as a composer, writer, and studio musician. And I just decided at that time I didn't want to play music for money anymore. And I quit and went into the book world, and when I did, I decided to specialize in African American literature, history, etc. And I like studying, and so what can I say? I've been studying ever since. And if one is interested, I mean, there's no way you can. I've been asked many times, how do you study to do something like I do? And there's no single way. You have to really be passionate about something, and you have to look everywhere. You have to read a lot and study, and that's what I do. And every appraisal that comes along is a learning process for me. I have to say I'm just a perennial student. I'm constantly learning. And there's something, you know.
I have a quick question, if you don't mind me asking.
Yeah.
How did, you know, what you're saying is very humble because I know a little bit about your background. But how is it that someone who started out in this business as a hobby wound up becoming affiliated with Skip Henry Louis Gates and Yale?
Wait, Harvard.
I'm sorry, Harvard.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, there are all kinds of ways to become, you know, to get to be a scholar in some area. In my case, I didn't major in this in college. Actually, I was a music major with a literature minor. But it so fascinated me all these years that I've read everything I could lay my hands on. Well, also, I have to say that when I decided to really go at this professionally, besides just being fascinated by it, I had a purpose in mind, and that was really to try and shed light on this history, on Africans and Africans in the diaspora, and that is Africans who have been wrenched out of their home and sent abroad. And that's it. It gave me a real sense of purpose too, besides something that I love to do. I mean, I really felt that this was something that really needed to be done because there's so much history has been either omitted on purpose or sort of lost by accident. But in some very, very complex way, the whole African American experience has been so distorted that I felt that the more we can unearth, the more we can shed light, maybe, you know, move things along.
Now, again, how are you affiliated with Harvard?
Well, I'm what's called a non-resident fellow, and a non-resident fellow is a scholar who's working on projects that, in this case, because it's for the Harvard's Du Bois Institute for Study of Black Studies, working on projects or a project for that is of some importance historically, and it means that I've been granted by Henry Louis Gates at Harvard the available what can I say, the studies and so forth at Harvard, the library, and I get their help, as it were.
So you have access.
A fellow at a university gets all of the benefits of that university's resources.
Could you take a class for free?
No. I could perhaps give a talk, what I could probably do, of course, is audit, you know, just sit in on a class. But that's not what my status is. A non-resident fellow is a scholar who has the resources of Harvard behind them, or Yale, or whoever. He's a non-resident fellow. Non-resident simply means I don't live up there. I'm not on campus. But I have the resources of Harvard. Harvard Studies Department and everything, the library, the Houghton Library and everything, at my disposal.
Excellent. Well, that's commendable. Now, for youngsters listening to our recording, what advice do you have for them while they're studying and trying to, as you say, unearth some of this material on Black history?
Well, I'll tell you what I tell everybody that asks me is devote some part of your day to reading about this history. Whatever it is, whether it's in a book or a newspaper article or some, you know, just, and you can't wait for this stuff to come to you. You have to go and get it. Get it at the library, get it from ask one of your teachers. I mean, if you're truly, truly interested, it's like learning how to play an instrument. I also teach kids how to play music. Devote some part of your day. Dedicate an hour, if you can, to study. It's that simple. And it'll give back to you 10 times over what you put in. Because every little bit of knowledge that you add to your storehouse of knowledge will lead you in another direction, will lead you towards something else, and that just will snowball. So that's my best advice to give you.
Well, I'm so glad that you called in and spoke to me live. I was disheartened that we couldn't get your introduction on during the show. So hopefully we'll get back together, definitely before your auction. You will have another sale in February, won't you?
I certainly shall. Certainly shall. I'd be happy to come back on. So my greetings to everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Wyatt Houston Day of Swan Galleries.
You're quite welcome. Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Block Talk family, that is our show, the Antique E-Show. I'm your host, Leslie Gist, and I look forward to talking to you again Sunday at 6 p.m.